Trendstorm.
Welcome to Radio Sputnik and Trendstorm. My name is Andrew Kripko, and I'm going to give you a forward-focused analysis of things to come and the general trends behind them. Here's what we have for you today. Hell in the Holy Land. The violence that broke out between Israelis and Palestinians earlier this week in Gaza during the opening of the American Embassy in Jerusalem turned the Holy Land into a living hell. Iran deal. Is the transatlantic rift for real? The Europeans' opposition to Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran deal and the workarounds that they're developing to evade forthcoming American sanctions have sparked talk of a developing transatlantic rift. And also, Mideast elections, democratic resistance. Last week's elections in Lebanon and this week's ones in Iraq showed that pro-Iranian resistance forces are as important of a force as ever in Mideast politics. Opening up this edition of Trendstorm are the latest events in Gaza. The violence that broke out between Israelis and Palestinians earlier this week in Gaza during the opening of the American Embassy in Jerusalem turned the Holy Land into a living hell. An estimated 35,000 Palestinians massed on the Israeli border with Gaza as part of their six-week-long March of Return protest against the U.S.'s decision late last year to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and relocate its embassy there. At least 59 unarmed protesters were gunned down by the Israeli military as they approached the border fence, and over 2,700 were injured by the tear gas and other means that were used to disperse them. Hell had indeed come to the Holy Land after the violence that took place, but it was perceived differently by each of the conflicting sides. The Palestinians were appalled at the disproportionate violence used against their unarmed protesters who were organizing in opposition to Trump's rejection of their claim to East Jerusalem as the capital of a future independent state. Many Israelis, meanwhile, saw the violence as a small price to pay in order to defend their borders and were nevertheless overjoyed at Trump's decision to move the American embassy to Jerusalem. These diametrically opposed attitudes to what just happened led to the jarring juxtaposition of many media outlets showing pictures of injured Palestinians in the smoke-filled Gazan war zone, right next to scenes of Trump's dressed-up daughter and son-in-law celebrating the opening of the new embassy. The message couldn't be any clearer, and it's that the U.S. and Israel were being portrayed as chillingly insensitive to the plight of the Palestinians that was happening right at the same time as their ceremony. Subsequent statements from Israeli officials justifying the violence that their armed forces used against the unarmed protesters contributed to this soft power fiasco and cast a dark pall over what was supposed to have been an historic day of pride for their people, but which is now looking more like a day of infamy. Altogether, and regardless of the different attitudes over what took place, the bloody events of the 14th of May signaled that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is once again heating up. If history is anything to go by, which it usually is, then this might portend the preparatory phase of another outbreak of large-scale conventional hostilities of the sort that last took place during Israel's so-called Operation Protective Edge in summer 2014. Folks, this is a very emotional and hot-button topic, so we're going to begin by speaking with Ms. Netka Bablicu to tell us more about things from the Palestinian side of what happened. She's the contributing editor at Eurasia Future. Netka, welcome to Trendstorm.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Netka, what did the Palestinians aim to accomplish during the large-scale protests on the 14th of May? If it was to draw global attention to their plight, then they succeeded, but they failed if they wanted to break through the border.
Andrew, look, the Palestinians have so little to lose at this stage. You know, they have little to lose, but possibly something to gain if they persevere. And God, do they persevere, despite their collective psyche, which has been crushed and demoralized for decades since the Nakba began in 1948, when over 700,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes and many also killed. For the Palestinians, the Great March of Return is a major cry for help, a cry for what is rightfully theirs, that was unlawfully taken away from them in 1948. And I say unlawfully because the land was promised to the Zionists by an occupying force, the British. And furthermore, it was actually never really approved by the UN. It was discussed, but never fully approved by international law. Washing one's hands of a situation, which is what the UN did, does not actually equate with approval. So it's really, this is not a complicated situation in any way, as many people claim it is, because it's convenient for them, right? This is the most cut and dry catastrophe in the world. An occupier state built illegally on an ancient land called Palestine at the great expense of the indigenous peoples, all of whom are called Palestinians. Imagine if the Italians suddenly decided that Britannia is Italian and decided to invade Britain and ethnically cleanse it, wipe it off the map, you know, using some sort of ancient mythological justification at best. This, you know, this just doesn't happen in 20th and 21st centuries. You know, the age of tribalism is over.
Okay, I see. You know, and you made a good case in explaining how the Palestinians actually did succeed in drawing global attention to their historic plight. Now, Nedka, I want to talk about the significance of the Turkish and Iranian reactions to this week's violence, because they were a lot louder than any Arab governments apart from Syria. So, Nedka, what does that say about the changing geopolitics of support for Palestine?
And sadly, so far, Palestine is always a consequence of changing geopolitical realities, if you know what I mean. It's not the cause. The Iranian reaction was to be expected. Iran has consistently stood for the Palestinian cause. And the same goes for Syria. You know, the commitment for the Palestinian liberation is embedded in the Syrian constitution, and they've never abandoned it, even during their dreaded war. Equally unsurprising, of course, was the muted response by other Arab countries to this latest atrocity. But what was more surprising was that Turkey's bellicose response, or not very surprising if you followed Turkey's recent geopolitical pivot, but nevertheless, regardless of Turkey's prior Euphrates Shield operation in Syria, which saw Turkey arming and funding anti-Assad terrorists who were on the same side as the Zionist regime, Turkey has made some drastic moves away from its NATO ally US and towards its Eurasian partners, Russia and Iran. Erdogan called Israel a terrorist state consistently, and the foreign minister of Turkey has called for an independent inquiry into the killings of Palestinian protesters. And most crucially, however, Turkey has expelled the Israeli ambassador. And so, naturally, the bilateral relations between these two countries are at an all-time low, when only 2 years ago, Israel and Turkey were discussing a joint pipeline, something that's unlikely to happen now since Israel has pivoted close to Turkey's adversary, Egypt, with now talk of another gas pipeline project between Israel, Egypt, Cyprus, Greece, and Italy. This, of course, won't go down well with the Turks at all, and it adds to the Turkish fury. And they usually, the Turks, I mean, they usually say what they mean and mean what they say. And so even if many people are doubtful of their intentions, the intentions are less relevant because, as everybody should know, in politics there are no friends or enemies, right, any interests. But if, even if Erdogan is using Palestine as a leverage against Israel and its allies, it doesn't matter so long as ultimately that's good for Palestine.
Okay, so Nedka, real briefly, considering that tensions are once again approaching the breaking point, what can realistically be done to de-escalate the situation before it spills over into another conventional conflict? Or, Nedka, do you believe that this eventuality is inevitable?
Well, to quote Arafat's famous words, "I come to you in olive branch in one hand and a freedom fighter's gun in the other. Do not let the olive branch fall from my hand." Sadly for everybody, Israel has not only let the olive branch fall, but it has continuously stepped on it. It has crushed it beyond repair, because Israel is not interested in peace. It's not interested in cooperation, because it can only survive through war, through intimidation, using its nuclear weapons as a means of bullying everybody who dares challenge it. You know, and whilst the Palestinians are being shot left and right, they're having tear gas thrown at them. You know, they continue undeterred. And whether there is another conventional conflict, it also depends on how things develop in Syria. How bellicose or not Israel gets in Syria, where it likes to test its strength. And, you know, whilst Israeli forces can easily kill defenseless Palestinians, it is careful to avoid a wider conventional war, because Palestinians and Syrians, they're both used to war. You see, they've learned to defend themselves with whatever means, and they don't have much. What we don't know is how the people of Israel would react to a conventional attack on Israeli soil. So Israel would probably be wise to pull back a little if it wants to save itself, but then again, you know, if it does so, the rightful owners of the land will reclaim their land. And since Israel does not believe in peaceful coexistence, which makes both the two-state and the one-state solution a dead duck, frankly, then it would have no choice but to capitulate. Hence, the nukes are so important to Israel. Without them, really, Israel will most likely cease to exist.
Nedka, this was a very sobering look at what's going on in Palestine, and thank you very much for telling our audience about it. Much appreciated. Now we're going to get the other side of the debate from Mr. Vladimir Golsang. He is an associate professor of Slavic studies at Brown University and frequent commentator on current affairs. All right, Vladimir, what's your response to Netanyahu's claim that the Israeli military was justified in its response to the protesters because of its obligation to protect its borders? And who's more to blame for what happened? Hamas, like Netanyahu claims, or the Israeli premier himself?
Well, I mean, blame game is the easiest thing to do, and I don't think it's particularly productive. What we know, it's a very kind of complex, systematic, you know, problem, which you know, should be solved in a very complex, systematic way, you know, because what we know, what we understand is Gaza is a festering wound. It's a, like, peculiar, you know, territory. People there just kind of bottle up. They don't have much of the rights. They don't have their passports. They don't have very good economic, you know, kind of means of surviving. So they're desperate. So desperate people, you know, use desperate means. And sort of it's the responsibility of, you know, the whole world. And that's, I think, what Netanyahu, if he really wants to sort of achieve some kind of comprehensive solution, should do, appeal to the whole world and say, you know, this is, you know, problem which have to be solved. And I think the same thing should be done by, you know, Hamas, by the Gaza leadership. Instead, they're just provoking each other, one in desperation, another, you know, side from arrogance. And, you know, the solution is not there. So my feeling is that, you know, both parts are blamed. But, you know, on the other hand, Israel has an upper hand, as Israel has all the means. But, you know, they have to sort of, you know, they cannot solve it themselves, obviously. Israel cannot absorb this giant territory, this giant amount of people. You know, they don't know what to do with them. It's a problem of Egypt. It's a problem of the whole world. And it has to be done with it. But what I also want to stress is recently Israeli politicians, and Netanyahu in particular, they seem to be, you know, getting on this arrogant sort of self-righteous horse. You know, and again, one cannot run the policy like that, but that we're always right, that we're surrounded by the enemies, and, you know, we can bomb our way into peace. We know by experience throughout history that you cannot really bomb your way into peace. You can win this battle or that battle, but it's not a lasting peace. You can bully people, you can subjugate people, but it's not a lasting peace. So they really need, you know, some other players to get involved. That's my reading of it. And I think players like big countries or UN, which have an authority. What bugs me a lot about the situation is the United States, you know, has all the power in the world in this region, but they don't have much of the authority. Everybody perceives them as being one-sided and solely on the side of Israel. So, you know, people wouldn't trust them that much. So I think Russia actually might have be in a very good position, you know, by its record and by sort of its rhetoric to introduce some kind of an objective, you know, power which can help to solve this very complicated problem.
Okay, these are some pretty good points, Vladimir. Now, observers noted that last Monday was the most violent day in Gaza since Israel's so-called Operation Protective Edge in summer 2014, with many now fearing that a similar mission might be launched in the near future. So, Vladimir, what do you foresee happening there in the coming weeks?
Well, I think there probably will be sporadic violence. I'm sure that, you know, not that many people are just, you know, desperate as they are. Not that many people are willing, sort of, you know, will be willing to go on and fight. And I'm sure that Israel will try to tone down both its rhetoric and its response. But, you know, even if this particular clashes in this particular situation will die out, you know, it wouldn't solve anything. It's like a festering wound which explodes, then somehow kind of it begins to you know, kind of close up, but it continues to fester. So what's important is not what will happen in 2 or 3 weeks, and there will be, of course, you know, a lot of spinning on all sides, and everybody will be, you know, taking their own sides and blaming each other. But what's important is that, you know, the world will get seriously involved with that. But, you know, unfortunately, I don't see, you know, real a willingness sort of to get involved. So, you know, this is both leadership have to definitely tone down their rhetoric. Israel should stop viewing itself as being under siege. You know, Hamas should stop sort of, you know, saying that we need all the territory of Israel, and, you know, it's ours, and you guys just get lost. This is not productive. You know, eventually they will find some kind of solution where people would coexist there, but, you know, definitely rhetoric and everything else should be turned down. It doesn't help anyone.
Okay, well, one of the things that might be on the horizon is the rumored American-Saudi Mideast peace plan that could be rolled out sometime real soon. I mean, we're not sure, but I'm going by some reports that I've read. Now, Vladimir, in light of the weeks of violent events in Gaza, do you anticipate this proposal? We don't really have any details, but just in general from what we've heard, being another conflict escalation trigger, or could it be a peacemaking breakthrough that might jumpstart much-needed negotiations?
No, I don't believe in any of that. I think there's two countries, Saudis and America, are still kind of, you know, view Middle East as their kind of their territory where they can use some proxy forces and push their own agenda. I'm not sure that they are really much interested in the peace there. The peace should be involved all sides, you know, including, say, Iranians and including, of course, Israelis, who will sit down and talk. And what is even more important is not just talk, but a massive, massive financial investment. I think if United States and Saudis are willing to invest into Gaza to the amount of, say, equivalent of the Marshall Plan, which they did in Germany, then they can reconstruct the Gaza, and Gaza can become a jewel of the land. And then everybody will want to live there rather than run away or feel bottled up or feel closed up. But I'm not sure they're going to give their money. They prefer probably the struggle sort of, you know, to go on. So Saudis will stick it to Iranians. Americans will sort of, you know, try to fish their own sort of fish in muddy waters. So I think, you know, I'm not sure. These two countries, they don't have in this area, I think, enough of their moral clout. They might have a financial clout, but which they're not going to use, but they definitely don't have a moral clout sort of to bring some lasting peace.
Okay, Vladimir, you gave us a lot to reflect on during our conversation. It was very thought-provoking, and thanks a lot.
Trendstorm.
Now, folks, if we think back on what both Netka and Vladimir share with us today, both of our guests agreed that what happened was regrettable. But at the end of the day, they seem to be laying a little bit of different blame over what happened. Netka sees Israel as entirely responsible for this, whereas Vladimir is taking a more nuanced approach and has some criticisms of Hamas and the way that they don't want to compromise, as he put it. Now, at the end of the day, this is Israel and Palestine. This is an issue that people just agree to disagree on. There is no perfect solution in sight. But that being said, we're going to hope for the best, but both parties seem to be preparing for the worst. So folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. Stay with us.